Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. If I ask you about your childhood, you're probably going to remember a time when you felt like something wasn't fair. Your sibling got ice cream and you didn't. Your classmate was being obnoxious and you ended up getting punished. But how about this story?
I'm Carson. I'm 18 years old.
Carson is in Sydney, Australia, and he talked to us through Skype. He didn't want to say his last name, and the reasons for that will become obvious. Carson had been talking to his parents about buying a car, nothing fancy. He'd been saving money since he was 14, and he needed to have a car to get to his part-time job at McDonald's. He was doing well in school, working hard, and his parents said they would pitch in half of whatever he decided to get. Up to $5,000. But then Christmas was getting closer, and Carson thought that maybe his parents would just buy him the car as a gift. Finally, Christmas morning came.
I come downstairs, and my sister is screaming, like she's ecstatic.
His sister and parents were outside. She's hugging her parents, jumping up and down with joy. And next to her, a brand new Hyundai with a giant red bow on the front. A car that's worth about $25,000. Carson turned to his parents and asked who the car was for. They told him, it's for your sister, who, by the way, didn't have a job and had dropped out of school.
I was crushed. I didn't know what to say. So I didn't say anything. I just stood there for a couple of seconds. And I kind of wanted to punch her, actually.
Carson didn't do that. He just walked back to his room, and then he saw a small present under the Christmas tree with his name on it, so he unwrapped it.
It was a phone case, and I think that just added salt to the wound. I was so let down. I was so disappointed. I was just, crushed.
So you're probably feeling like Carson got a raw deal, right? His sister gets a car and he gets a phone case? Like, that's not fair. Fairness is important to us in our relationships, at work, in politics. Right now, for example, we're having lots of political debates over healthcare reform, and fairness is a major issue with that. Who has access to treatment? Who can afford insurance? On today's episode, we'll examine our desire for fairness, where that desire comes from, and what fairness looks like in different situations. Let's start with our desire for fairness. If you think about Carson getting a phone case and not a car, we feel bad for him, right? But we don't know anything else about the story or his parents' reasons for this weird, unfair distribution of Christmas gifts. So why do we care about this? Whatever it is, it's fueling a super active page on Reddit called AITA, Am I the Asshole? Or let's just say bad guy. It has millions of followers. Carson posted his story on that site. Here's how it works. People describe situations where they felt mistreated or slighted. And then users weigh in and vote. Who's the bad guy here? Our reporter Liz Tung has become obsessed with this subreddit, and she has this story.
Am I the A word? I'm just going to call it AITA for short, was started back in 2013 by a guy named Mark Bolak. Mark wanted help with a dispute that had recently divided the men and women at his office. Their beef, who got to control the thermostat?
I had to wear a suit every day. Other people did not have to dress so warmly. And during the summer, they didn't like the fact that the air conditioning was at what I thought was a reasonable number 72.
The women, many of whom wore skirts to work, wanted the office at a toastier temperature. But the men felt like they should just layer up. and were ready to draw a line in the sand. But Mark was hesitant.
So I thought, am I kind of mansplaining fashion to people who have to follow rules that I'm not even aware of? So I just kind of wanted to have somebody else outside of my social circle give me the response, give me the judgment before I went ahead and blurted it out. So I went online, I made my space, I asked the question, and one person found it and responded and kind of said it sounded like I was right. So the rest is history.
Mark says the subreddit's name, Am I the A-Word, while it might sound kind of crude, is meant to encourage people to be self-critical and reflective about the role they might be playing in a conflict. The final judgment is decided by commenters. There are four ways to vote, and again, I'm going to paraphrase here to keep it clean. You're not the bad person. You are the bad person. Everyone's bad here, or no one's bad here. Posts cover everything from profound family dramas to spats over chores and household bills to more unique situations, like the guy who wondered if he was a jerk for single-handedly eating 4 feet of a party sub all by himself. For the most part, the stories are pretty mundane. But another AITA moderator, Elizabeth, who asked that we just use her first name to avoid harassment from internet trolls, says that's actually part of the appeal.
And I think that is one of what makes it kind of relatable to people when they see these kind of small things like fighting with their roommate, fighting with their sibling. They actually have a space to really explore a conflict that people have brushed off in the past as too insignificant to really pay any attention to.
6 years after its creation, AITA has racked up almost 2 million subscribers and generates upwards of 700 posts every day, along with thousands and thousands of comments. So why all the passion? To find out, I talked with Katie McCullough. She's a professor at the psychology department at Boston College, and she's published more than a dozen studies on fairness. Katie says our sense of fairness actually is almost like a kind of fundamental drive. In fact, it starts before we can even talk.
Even as early as infancy, so in the first year or two of life, children start to have expectations, or it looks as though they have expectations that things should be divided up equally.
Katie has done a number of studies on children's sense of fairness. Basically, she pairs them up, gives them an unequal number of candies, and then sees how they react. She says for the first few years of life, kids are totally happy to get more candy than their partner. But around the age of 8, something magical happens. They start turning down the extra candy in the name of fairness.
And this was really, really surprising both to us and to the parents who are watching their children participate in this task. You know, their children are throwing away 4 candies to prevent a partner who they've never met before from getting less than them.
Katie and her colleagues have done these experiments around the world to see if kids' sense of fairness is culturally specific. They found that notions of fairness differ from place to place, but
fairness does seem to be a universal concept in that people across cultures seem to care about fairness.
In fact, researchers have found that there actually seems to be a biological basis for a preference for fairness. Golnaz Tabibnia is a neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine, who's done research on how our brains react to fairness and unfairness. She and her team took brain scans of people as they were receiving fair and unfair offers as part of a game. As it turned out, when they were getting offered a raw deal,
the anterior insula gets activated when we're treated unfairly. And this part of the brain, incidentally, also gets activated when we see or smell or taste something disgusting.
But when they got a good offer,
you see activation in the reward circuit, including the ventral striatum. And people report greater happiness. So there seemed to be something about fairness in and of itself, kind of independent of the material outcome that it's associated with, that's activating the reward circuit.
These are powerful reactions. Pleasure on the one hand, disgust on the other. Being treated fairly doesn't just activate our reward centers. It actually makes us feel happy. According to Alan Sanfi, a brain cognition and behavior researcher in the Netherlands, the opposite, unfair treatment, stirs up a complicated cocktail of negative emotions.
We know anger is a part. We know disgust is a part. Sometimes sadness can be a part. So each of these emotions are kind of accumulated in this feeling of unfairness.
And researchers have found we don't just have this reaction when we're the direct recipients. It can even happen when we're just witnessing unfair treatment. Goldnaz says that could be what's prompting so much passion from the commenters on AITA.
At least observing these third-party bad behaviors is triggering something in us that's very strong. And I see the connection in, like, the desire to want to incur punishment.
We can't exactly punish bad actors through our computer screens, but we can do something.
It's public shaming, and that's a really profound punishment, I would think. Social evaluation is one of the more robust ways to stress people out physiologically. The threat of bad, poor social evaluation, I should say, is like one of the more reliable ways to get people's cortisol levels to go up.
That's the stress hormone, which in high levels can cause everything from anxiety and depression to heart disease. Katie McCullough, the researcher from Boston University, says this desire to punish unfair treatment, even when it doesn't affect us directly, is evidence of how important our sense of fairness really is.
And I think that this really speaks to this idea that the fairness norm itself is so privileged in our society, and it's important that we not only uphold that norm when we're the victim of unfairness, but when we see anyone as the victim of unfairness, because we need to make sure that this norm is upheld for everyone's benefit, in a sense.
So the big appeal of Am I the A-Word isn't about rubbernecking at people's problems. At least it's not just about that. We care about fairness because we want to be treated fairly. It's what fosters cooperation.
And human cooperation is so essential, right, to our everything. Like, our whole entire society is based on cooperation. So we can achieve more together than we can achieve alone. And fairness gives us a way of making sure that those relationships remain productive, and they can help protect us from working with bad partners, essentially.
Which is not to say that AITA is necessarily the best arbiter of what's fair or what isn't. We're just hearing one side of the story in these posts, and commenters are bringing their own baggage to their judgments. But another one of the moderators, her name's Claire, she again asked that we only use her first name to avoid internet trolls, says that's not necessarily the point.
It's a way to gain some perspective, or, you know, to see a new way of thinking about your situation that maybe you weren't able to think of on your own.
And hopefully that perspective will make the posters and all of us a little bit more fair overall.
That was Liz Tong reporting. Right now, over 100,000 people in the U.S. are waiting for an organ. They need a transplant, and their health is deteriorating as they wait. Who should get the next organ that becomes available?
Trying to be fair in a situation where it's life and death is very, very tough.
That's medical ethicist Arthur Kaplan. More than 30 years ago, he was involved in creating a wait list for organ distribution.
You know, the whole system started out as very unfair. Organs were going to the rich. Organs were going to people who had connections. Organs were going to people who could be squeaky wheels and say, you know, my kid needs a transplant, and get in the media of that time. It was just unfair to the extreme.
So the new waitlist system was put into place to make the process fair and to get organs to people in a timely manner.
Because we were wasting too many. We literally would throw them away if they weren't used at the place where they were obtained, and that was crazy.
The waitlist now takes different factors into account in terms of who gets the next available kidney or heart or liver. It's one thing to think about what's fair in the abstract, but every single person on that list has a story, a family, a desperate need. William Johnson's name is on the list. He's waiting for a kidney, and in the meantime, he has to have dialysis several times a week.
I'll admit, the first 6 to 8 months of doing this, I was an awful individual. I yelled at people, cussed them out while yelling at them. Guess what? It didn't get me anywhere. It didn't get me any better.
William says he's come to accept the treatment as part of life.
Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm in that routine. It's like, it's work. It is literally like work. I have to be there at a certain time. It's like a job.
Michael Bonk is also on the organ wait list. He's had diabetes since he was a child, but then his health got much worse and doctors told him he needed a new kidney and pancreas.
Obviously, you say, why me? Everybody is going to say that when you get such a heavy diagnosis. Was it mistakes that you made? Was it choices you made? Was it your parents? And to be honest with you, there is no answer.
Michael says never knowing when he might get a match has been weighing on him, especially if he thinks about what has to happen for him to get an organ.
My donor will have to be deceased because I'm getting a pancreas. It puts it in a different realm. I could not possibly sit here and say, I can't wait till a donor comes up. Because you know, unfortunately, that person has to pass. And that's kind of a mental thing that you have to go through and think about. And that's a lot. You don't really want that to happen.
So think about Michael and William and 100,000 more people in the U.S. all stuck in limbo, waiting. What is fair to all of them? Medical ethicist Art Kaplan says the distribution system that's in place now is way better than things used to be. But there are still weak spots. For example, to even get on the list, people have to first get accepted into an organ transplant program.
Now, when you come, the transplant program is going to evaluate you. And they evaluate you in many different ways. They're going to say, how old are you? If you're 90 years old, chances are you're not going to get admitted to the transplant center. They may say you're just too old to survive a transplant. They look at things like, can you pay? So money, or as I sometimes call it, the wallet biopsy, is a big test for many different types of transplant just to get into a program.
Michael Bonk didn't pass the wallet biopsy with the first transplant center he tried to get into.
They asked me what my insurance was, and I explained to them that I had Medicaid insurance. At that point, I wasn't working, and I was struggling financially. And they said, what's your second form of insurance? And I said, well, that's the only insurance I have. And they wouldn't see me. They wouldn't schedule me to come in and talk to anybody or anything. They said, you need to get a second form of insurance, then call us back. I hung up the phone, and I was just mortified. I said, I'm not going to be the guy that gets a transplant. It's just not going to happen for me.
Michael has since found a different transplant center that did accept him. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan says beyond finances, these centers also evaluate if you're a good fit in other ways.
You're also going to take a look and see what's your habits and your health status. Are you using drugs? Do you drink a lot? Do you have mental health issues? Are you someone who's likely to be compliant? Are you someone who's shown over the years that you're not big at taking directions? They may wonder if you speak English, and you may wonder why they care about all this, because the easier you are to deal with, the easier it is for them to have a good outcome with you.
So that's just the first hurdle people have to clear. And once you're in, the waitlist rules kick in.
Then they're going to say, Art Kaplan, you have liver failure. We're going to put you on the liver list. And a couple of factors will determine what happens to me. One is, does an organ become available that matches my blood type and my tissue type?
That part has been a challenge for William Johnson, who is waiting for a kidney.
I'm B negative, so me getting a kidney anytime soon is going to be almost impossible. When I started this 2 years ago, the wait time was 3 to 5 years. This year, it went up to 5 to 7 years and possibly longer because I'm B negative blood type. We're less than 5% of the entire population.
Art Kaplan says geography is also a deciding factor.
If I'm competing with someone who's 1,000 miles away, but the donor died 1,000 miles away too, nearer to the other person who might match, they're probably going to beat me and get that organ. Then in some situations, they're going to want to know, how sick are you? Because if I'm really sick, almost dead, I might bump up to the top of the list and they'll say, well, we'll try to rescue you. Ironically, if I have the flu or some other infection, they may say, we're passing over you because we can't put an organ in you and then put all this immunosuppression into you. The flu will go crazy and kill you. So a lot of different variables, but there is a system that ranks people, and they're also aware of how long I've been waiting. 30 days, 60 days, 90 days.
Now, Art says this system is pretty fair to everybody on the list, but you can game the system. If you have lots of money and resources, you can get yourself enrolled at several transplant centers at once. That ups your chances of getting an organ. Also, people have questioned whether prisoners should be eligible to be on the transplant list, or people with intellectual disabilities have been discriminated against. And there have also been lawsuits, right? And attempts to force the system to be changed.
A number of lawsuits have occurred over the years. People with children who have had Down have sued and said, you know what? We want our kid under the Americans with Disabilities Act listed along with everybody else. Don't tell me about intellectual capacity. And we're going to sue if you don't put that kid on the list and let them, if you will, compete against other kids. And they've won those suits. And some people have sued and said, you know what, I may be a prisoner, but all I did was a minor crime, and you shouldn't kill me for that, so I have the right to be in the transplant pool, and some of those people have won.
And have there been efforts to standardize how transplant centers admit people into these programs in the first place?
You know, it's interesting. We spent a lot of time with the distribution system of people admitted to transplant centers in the big computer. But we haven't spent as much time trying to standardize the individual judgments that transplant centers make about letting you get in so that you can put your ticket into the system. So there are no real hard and fast rules. Transplant centers get to make choices. Some of that makes sense. If you're a very difficult case, many diseases, complications, you're harder to transplant. A new transplant program may say, we can't handle that and we're not going to take that patient. Okay. As long as they refer you to somebody else, I don't have a problem with that. That's a good judgment. But when transplant centers are saying, gee, we are not doing very well, our statistics are poor, we're only going to admit the best or the easiest patients, no one's really tracking them down in an aggressive manner and saying, hey, we're going to audit you regularly and your numbers look bad, maybe we don't need you to be doing transplants. I'm not going to say we don't shut transplant programs that don't do well ever, but we don't do it enough.
What do you see could possibly happen over the next decade or so that would shake up the system and maybe make it easier?
One thing we can do is continue to press people to be organ donors. A lot of people aren't. And I think that's tragic, and we got to figure out ways to change their minds.
One idea is to make organ donation an opt-out system instead of the current opt-in system when you're getting your driver's license. Arthur Kaplan heads the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine. There's a lot of debate about healthcare reform right now and how to make the health insurance system fair for more people. A lot of people are mad because they feel like they are being punished for having a chronic illness. Others are asking, why should I be paying for somebody else's health problems, especially if maybe they haven't been taking care of themselves? What's fair to the most people and how do we pay for it? Joining me now is health reporter Dan Gorenstein. He's the host of the podcast Trade-Offs, which covers health policy. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Megan.
So, Dan, you did an episode about two friends who've spent most of their careers trying to reinvent health insurance.
Right. Yeah. Health economist Mike Chernew, who's at Harvard, and Dr. Mark Fendrick, who's at the University of Michigan. Mark Fendrick will always get mad if he goes second, but that's okay.
Mark is the head of the Slinky Dog. I'm the ass. Mark runs ahead. We get all stretched out, and then I catch up to him and smack him from behind.
So Mike is an economist. Mark is a physician.
When they were just starting out their careers, Mike, and they really were two buddies. They would talk over lunch about this thing that Mark, as the physician, started to see, because what would happen is he would have people who have chronic conditions, asthma, diabetes, things like this, things that are really sort of controllable, they'd come into his office and they would say to him, part of the reason why my diabetes is out of control is because I can't afford the insulin. It's too expensive. And Mark would sort of tear his hair out and go to the economist, Mike, and say, you know, Mike, what is up? Why are there these insurance plans that are charging copays and making it expensive for people who need medical care to get that medical care?
So they came up with a concept that is called VBID.
Value-based insurance design is what it stands for. At one point, Fendrick told me he hoped it would become as synonymous as SCUBA, whatever SCUBA stands for, but VBID has yet to be a household name. The basic idea behind value-based insurance design was, could you create an insurance plan, even if it had out-of-pocket costs like deductibles and copays, could you create it so that the high-value stuff would actually be affordable?
And that high-value stuff, that's those medications and procedures or tests that Mark was prescribing or ordering to keep his patients healthy.
Like insulin or an asthma inhaler, you'd get that covered at almost no out-of-pocket cost. That was the basic idea.
And they were successful with their ideas, right? They wrote a chapter of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, they got a provision into the Affordable Care Act that gave people lots of access to basic screenings and checkups for free. They were successful, but at the same time, it opened a can of worms that they didn't quite expect. Here's Mark Fendrick telling me about that.
I have received countless messages from people saying, thank you for the free mammography. I now can't afford the cost of my biopsy and surgery. Thank you for allowing my relative to have access to free colorectal cancer screening. I now have to get a second mortgage on my home to pay for chemotherapy.
So Mark's patients were getting access to free tests and preventative screenings, but when a problem arose, they still couldn't pay for the actual care that they really needed.
The Affordable Care Act was good at sort of expanding access, but not necessarily great at making healthcare fundamentally more affordable.
And now, to perhaps complicate matters, since the Affordable Care Act, millions of Americans have gotten plans that are high deductible health plans, right? Where you fork over the first couple of $1,000s of care. And that again has had a big impact on people with chronic health issues, right? So what do these two say about that?
Right. So fundamentally, these guys are concerned with fairness. And how do you create a healthcare product, an insurance product that's going to protect people who, by no fault of their own, are sick? And how do you treat them fairly, right? So they're not punished because they've got some chronic condition. So they've come up with a plan, sort of almost a VBID 2.0. They call it VBID X. They need some marketing help. But under this VBID X idea, basically what they're talking about is, you know, we talked about identifying high-value care, the insulin and the asthma inhaler. But then the problem is, if you give an asthma inhaler to somebody at low or no cost, somebody's got to pay for it, right? Like, the price doesn't go away. Even if these people are sort of legitimately need it, it's still got to be paid for. So Mark and Mike were trying to think, well, how do we get ourselves out of this? And the solution they've puzzled on now is to say, well, what if we try to make the high value care affordable, but low-value care, like vitamin D screenings. Most people do not need vitamin D screenings. There are certain types of MRIs, imaging, you know, screens for like back pain or whatever, or certain types of blood tests. Some of these things really are excessive. And if somebody wants one of those excessive or low-value procedures, then they should have to pay more for it. There'll be a premium put on that. And the money being spent on those things will go to offset the cost of the high value, the asthma inhalers and the rest. So that's the idea behind VBIDX.
And is that idea becoming a reality?
Maybe. you know, Fendrick and Chernu are always, one of the reasons why they've had success with VBID, whatever iteration of VBID, is because they've just kept going. They've talked to people in Washington. They've talked to people at the state level. They're in conversations with some of the exchanges where people buy insurance through the exchange, through Obamacare, about maybe trying to see if they can ramp up some sort of VBIDX plan. So it's sort of to be determined. We'll see.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Mike.
Dan Gorenstein is the host of the podcast Trade-Offs. This story was part of their episode, The Good Stuff. Coming up, can we outsource fairness to algorithms?
That's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous assumption to have that a piece of technology can predict human behavior in advance.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about fairness, why we care about it, and how we define it in different situations. With artificial intelligence, we're leaving more and more thinking to machines. If we want computers to make decisions for us, we have to be deliberate in how we program them. Think about self-driving cars, for example. In some rare situations, let's say a brake failure or an unavoidable crash, those cars will get to decide who will live and who will die. Can we program them to make these decisions fairly? To think through this problem, we first have to decide what we think of as fair in a situation like that. And there's a thought experiment along those lines. It's called the trolley problem. It goes like this. A runaway trolley is speeding along the tracks, and the brakes are not working. Ahead, five workers are trapped on the track. You're standing at this lever. Do nothing, and five people will die. If you pull the lever, the trolley switches to another track where only one worker is trapped, and it kills him. What do you do? I asked Iyad Rahwan about this a few years ago. He is an associate professor at the MIT Media Lab. So one choice is to pull the lever. That's the utilitarian response.
Which means I should take the action that will produce the best outcome. And in this case, the best outcome is to kill fewer people, so I should pull the lever.
The other option is to do nothing, because by pulling the lever, you are taking an active part in what's about to happen.
The action itself of killing a person through performing an act is intrinsically wrong, regardless of the outcome, and therefore those people will just receive their fate, and a human being is wrong to take an action that will alter that.
So with self-driving cars, how do we want them to decide in life and death situations?
Now, the fundamental difference is that now it is not a human being with ethical intuitions who's making these decisions, but rather it's a computer program. It's an algorithm that is designed and built by people, but that is acting autonomously in the real world in that moment.
But do we as humans do any kind of ethical analysis before making a decision in a situation where we might crash into a wall, killing ourselves, or we might crash into a crowd of people?
That's a very good question. So obviously humans do not make any sort of explicit, conscious ethical analysis in these scenarios. What happens mostly is people freak out, they freeze, and they do an action that is random, that is driven by their gut feeling or their fear or their self-preservation instinct. Now, the difference here is that for the first time in the history of automotives, we're able to make that decision prior to that moment. So in a way, you now have a moral imperative to make the right choice.
So Rahwan and his colleagues have created a website. It's called Moral Machine. And when you go on, you can go through a couple of different scenarios and you have to make choices. There are side-by-side images of a car about to get into an accident. Simple images looks a little bit like in a driver's manual from the DMV when you were first getting your permit. So the car could be programmed to go straight, that would mean killing pedestrians, or the car could be programmed to swerve off, hit a barricade, and kill the people in the car. That would include you. So you have to click on one or the other, and then the scenarios keep changing up. Sometimes there are more people in the car, sometimes fewer. The pedestrians are older, younger. They are bank robbers or doctors, so it gets really hairy.
We wanted people to confront the difficulty of making those types of moral decisions And to appreciate the complexity of those types of trade-offs that regulators and lawmakers have to make. If society does not want those cars to discriminate based on gender or age, for example, then society needs a way to articulate those expectations, and we need to ensure that they are implemented.
How do you think all of this will enter the production of these vehicles? I mean, ultimately, as a customer, don't I want a vehicle that will prioritize me?
Of course. So in our study, the first thing we found was that people, by and large, wanted cars to be utilitarian. So they wanted the cars to minimize total harm, regardless of whether it was sacrificing the passerby that the car would swerve towards or whether the car would sacrifice the passenger in the car. But the catch is that when we asked people whether they would purchase such cars, they all said absolutely not. And this is not really surprising. People have a self-preservation instinct. So I think it's not about what the car should do in scenario A or scenario B, but it's about the how society as a whole can come to an agreement about what matters to us more and how we can enforce this agreement. So if everybody wants cars that, in aggregate, minimize the death toll, minimize the total harm from accidents in general, we need a way to enforce that. So I need a way to make sure that if I purchase a car that may, in a very unlikely scenario, may sacrifice me, I need to make sure that I'm not the only one doing that, and that everybody else is buying into this social contract.
Iyad Rahwan is a professor at the MIT Media Lab and one of the developers of the website Moral Machine. We're talking about fairness right now in terms of algorithms and artificial intelligence. Several states are looking to computer algorithms to revamp different procedures in the judicial process. Who should be allowed to get out of jail on bail? Who should stay in? How long should a prison sentence be? Many people think algorithms could make better decisions that are based on data, and maybe they would bring more fairness to the process. But is that really possible? Alan Yu reports.
When judges sentence offenders, they consider what is fair in terms of the crime and how likely that person is to offend again.
Sometimes people think it's easy what we do. It really isn't.
Laurie Dumas has been a judge for more than a decade in family and criminal courts in Philadelphia.
We're responsible for lives.
She says she knows people end up in front of her because they did something. But she also considers that a criminal record, as a result of her ruling, will likely affect the rest of their lives, what kind of job they can get. She thinks about someone's childhood, work history, mental health, whether they show remorse. She follows the law first. But within that, she can have quite a bit of discretion.
Too often, you know, people think that all judges should be able to look at the law and look at a fact situation and rule the same way. Whereas the reality is that you can have one particular set of facts heard by five different judges and get five different results. And that's based on the fact that we are people before we come to the bench.
For example, she is a parent. Her point of view in juvenile court will probably be different than a judge who does not have children.
Our own background, I would say, is probably 95% of the reason why what you may hear in one courtroom is totally different than what you may hear in another.
If she thinks she needs more information about a case, she can ask for it. School records, child welfare history, even a psychological evaluation. 10 years ago, Pennsylvania lawmakers decided there was a problem with how all this worked.
It was totally arbitrary.
That's Todd Stevens, a state representative and chairman of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing.
Judges were just on their own deciding, well, geez, this defendant in front of me seems like I might need to take a closer look and get more information about this defendant. But there was no evidence-based or data-driven objective standard for requesting that additional information. It was done on a whim. Every judge had their own internal set of criteria that they might use on whether or not to get more information about a particular offender.
Two people with similar backgrounds and who committed the same crime could get totally different sentences depending on which judge they faced. So in 2010, a state commission got to work on an algorithm, a formula that would allow a computer to predict how likely a person is to commit another crime. It would recommend when judges should get more information about a case. The goal was to make sentencing more consistent and to reduce prison populations and lead to less crime. Mark Bergstrom is the executive director of the Commission on Sentencing.
You try to take advantage of lots of information, lots of experiences. So that's actuarial data. So when we started our project, we didn't look at a handful of cases. We looked at over 200,000 cases to try to see what factors sort of related to positive and negative outcomes. And that's information that judges didn't have or didn't have in a sort of a structured kind of way.
The formula will look for patterns based on a person's age, gender, what crime they're being convicted of, and how many, whether they've been convicted of a crime before, what crime was that, and whether they have a juvenile record. It cannot take race into account, or county, which is seen as a proxy for race. The judge will still make the ultimate decision on sentencing. The algorithm will be rolled out this year and evaluated after 12 months. It took 10 years to make because it was so controversial. For one thing, critics were afraid a tool built from criminal justice data would still discriminate against people of color. Pennsylvania is more than 80% white. Almost half the prison population is black. Here's Todd Stevens again, state representative and chair of the Sentencing Commission.
We took every step that we thought we could to prevent race from being a factor, and on top of that, we've required this review within a year to ensure that it is in fact not a factor.
Reuben Jones is not buying it.
That's like saying we're going to take the salt from the sea.
He is an activist and leads campaigns to end mass incarceration in Philadelphia.
The reality is there are a lot of proxies for race that are utilized in these risk assessment tools. So we can't pretend that you can't determine a person's race, you know, by other means other than asking what's your address.
He also questions whether data from the past can say something meaningful about someone's future. When he was 22, Reuben was convicted of robbery and aggravated assault. That was not his first arrest. He went to prison for 15 years. Since his release, he has gotten a master's degree, become a community leader. He says a risk assessment tool could not have predicted that.
The risk assessment, ideally, I guess, in their minds, will tell them who's going to create a crime in the future. And I'm saying that that's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous assumption to have that a piece of technology can predict human behavior in advance.
Because the risk assessment depends on one big assumption, that what happened in the past 200,000 cases tells us something about what's going to happen with the next person. He says that is not fair.
Individualized justice is what we need. So when someone comes in front of a judge, forget the algorithms and all those things, talk to them like they're a human being, and see, what does this person in front of me need?
Virginia already uses a similar risk assessment tool. It started in the early 2000s. There, the number of people in prison did not go down. Recidivism did not go down. And black people were slightly more likely to be incarcerated. Megan Stevenson studied the effects of their tool. She is an assistant professor of law at George Mason University. So, did the tool fail? Megan says it's not that simple.
The impacts of a risk assessment tool don't just depend on the statistical properties of the algorithm. They depend on how human beings respond to the algorithm, when they choose to follow it, when they choose to ignore it.
Here's an example, and it takes us back to this question of whether it's fair to use the past to predict the future. When young people committed a crime, the risk assessment tool said these people are likely to commit more crime, sentenced them harshly. But judges systematically said no. Were the judges wrong? On one hand, it's well documented that criminals tend to do more crime when they're young and less when they're older. So statistically, yes, young age is a strong predictor for future crime.
If the goal at sentencing was simply to lock up those at the highest risk of reoffending, there's an argument to be made that you should just lock up all teenage boys and throw away the key and let them out when they turn 28 or 30. Now, of course, many people would find that idea really repugnant.
Judges in Virginia thought it's not fair to punish a young person as harshly as the algorithm suggested, even though it says young people are at a higher risk of doing more crime. Maybe judges thought teens are impulsive, their brains aren't fully formed, being in prison could actually be worse, so they went a little easy on them. Megan also agrees with Ruben that there is no risk assessment algorithm that can strip out the long history of racial inequity, or even outright racism, in the criminal justice system.
Other people phrase it as a would-you-rather question. Would you rather be sentenced by a judge who is also potentially racist, who is being influenced by this track record that is an imperfect proxy for actual criminal behavior? Or would you rather be sentenced by an algorithm, you know, in which at least race is not an explicit input? And I don't think there's a clear answer.
She says there are arguably better ways to reduce racial inequality in the criminal justice system than using an algorithm. Real accountability.
If the racial disparities in sentencing decisions were tracked at the judge level, made public, incorporated into re-election campaigns, I think judges would really start paying attention to racial disparities, and I think we would see them shrink.
The criminal justice example illustrates a lot of the broader questions about using algorithms, or even machine learning, in making decisions for us. For one thing, it forces us to spell out in detail what is fair and what is not.
You should never expect machine learning to do something for free that you didn't explicitly ask it to do for you. And you should also never expect it to avoid behaviors that you wanted to avoid that you didn't tell it explicitly to avoid.
That's Michael Kearns, a computer scientist at the University of Pennsylvania. He says if you want an algorithm to really be fair to people of all ages, ethnic groups, races, disability status, gender identity, you're going to have to state that. First, you have to define what you think is fair. You have to decide and code for the kind of fairness you want. And you're still not done.
It's not like we kind of tick off items on a checklist and then we have an ethical decision-making model and then we just deploy it.
That's Annette Zimmerman, a political and moral philosopher at Princeton University. Annette says we have to keep reflecting on how an algorithm is working or not working and how we can fix it. An algorithm cannot tell us what's fair, and it can only ever be as good as what we put into it.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Our intern is Sabrina Ems. We have production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.